just read a poem to begin with. A woman can't survive by her own breath alone. She must know the voices of mountains. She must recognize the forgiveness of blue. She must flow with the elusive bodies of night wind woman who will take her into her own self. Look at me. I am not a separate woman. I am a continuance of blue sky. I am the throat of the Sandia Mountains, a night wind woman who burns with every breath she takes. And a comment. Quiet contemplation each day is training for the mind. As the mind opens, there is joy. So, I am a long-time student of Gill's. I've been with him since he started teaching in 1990. And I teach occasionally here and also in San Jose. How many of you are brand new to practice? Okay, so all of you have had some basic instruction and been here. Okay. What I want to talk about this evening is the value of our practice. You know, why are we here? Why do we come here on New Year's Day? We could be home with family or friends or doing something else, but each of us made a conscious choice to be here on this day. What is it that brings us here? What is it that says, yes, that's what I want to do tonight? And perhaps we're aware, perhaps we're not. When I first started practicing, I couldn't have told you why I started. I couldn't have told you why I kept going. In fact, I was asked. And for years, I said, I don't know. I don't know. I just kept going. Something beyond my ego, beyond my conscious mind, brought me to practice and kept me there. And of course, I'm eternally grateful that it did. So partly because it's New Year's, and I'm thinking about New Year's and thinking, what would be an appropriate topic for this New Year's Day? And then partly because of an experience I had last Sunday evening, I'm inspired to talk about our practice. And the experience I had was I went to San Quentin to visit their sitting group. They have a four-year-old sitting group that meets on Sunday evenings from about 6 to 8, 8:15, something like that. And it's led by two men from San Francisco Zen Center. And I'm part of a chaplaincy training program. So through that program, our visits to San Quentin were arranged. And I was really looking forward to it. I didn't know quite what to expect, but I do some work in a county jail down in Milpitas. So partly because of that and hearing things about how different prison is and having read this book, Finding Freedom, written by a man in San Quentin, I was very interested to go. And I was very awed, impressed, inspired, touched by my experience there. There were about 10 men, Lee, the teacher, two other women from Green Gulch, and four of us, four women from the chaplaincy program. And, you know, it can be a little eerie going through the gates and knowing that you're entering San Quentin, that's probably world famous. But the courtyard that we first entered, which is called the chapel courtyard, it was dark by this time, so we really couldn't see it well, but we could see enough to see how beautifully laid out it was and how much care is taken. And someone said to me, well, you should see it in the summer when the roses are blooming. And that was the first thing that struck me. Wow, this beautiful courtyard in this massive maximum security prison that I've heard, you know, as we all have so much about. And then, for some reason, Buddhism is not recognized in the California penal system as a religion. I don't know why. So the room that they use is the Jewish and Islam room, the room that is used for both Jewish services and Islam. So that's a little interesting fact. But the men and Lee, the teacher, said the men will be coming any minute. I don't know how they knew we were there, how they get the word to come, but they did. And he said, they'll take care of everything. They'll set everything up. Sure enough, they came in. They got into the cupboards that seemed to be locked and pulled out all the equipment. In Zen, we sit on these, which are called zabutons. And the men had made these thick zabutons to sit on. They're the thickest, nicest zabutons I've ever seen. And they put them out in two rows facing each other. The zafus, the cushions, were all donated by Zen Center. And then they pulled out an altar that they had made in workshop. Beautiful. It's like a folding suitcase. In other words, you know, it was like a square suitcase, and then they opened it up and stacked one part on the other and brought out their incense and a statue and some, I guess, silk flowers. Just amazing. The room was transformed in about 5 minutes to this lovely zendo. So then we all sat down, and I think there were a few words said, and then Lee said we would sit for 15 minutes and then they ring a bell so you can change position if you're uncomfortable, and then we'd sit another 15 minutes. I want you to know that room was silent. You could hear a pin drop. There was no movement. There was no bustle, you know, except for a few seconds after the bell rang. Otherwise, it was silent. I was so impressed. And then, you know, after the second bell, we did some chanting, and Lee had asked those of us from the chaplaincy program to talk about it a little bit, so there was a fair amount of talking. And then we took a break, and during the break, we could talk with the inmates, and we had been told that they were very eager to talk to us, which was true. But throughout the whole thing, I was struck by the dedication of these men to their practice. And as we'd been sitting, something occurred to me. I had taken note but hadn't really registered that all but one of them had gray hair. And as we were meditating, it dawned on me, oh my goodness, I'll bet these men were incarcerated when they were young and they have grayed in San Quentin, which is true. They've all been there long term. They were the nicest group of men you'd ever want to talk to. They were so serene. They were so calm. They were obviously so dedicated to this practice. It was truly amazing and inspiring. These men are finding freedom within the walls of San Quentin. Now, how they all came to practice, I don't know. I don't know any of their stories or histories or anything. I know this group has been going for 4 years. Two men I talked to said they'd been practicing for 2.5 years. You know, I don't know much more than that about them. But I know what I felt. And I felt this incredible serenity. Now, in thinking about it afterwards, I thought, well, I wonder if it's all from practice. I mean, some of it must be. But perhaps some of it comes from they've been in San Quentin for 20 years or 25 or whatever number. There was one incident just as we were leaving that stuck with me. I don't know what was going on, but we were all walking out together. Some of the inmates had already gone on, and there were maybe half a dozen still there, and then those of us that were leaving. And something was said over the loudspeaker. I didn't understand it. I didn't hear it. But the inmates all went down. They crouched down on their knees. They obviously had heard it and understood it. And what they said to us was, don't worry, you don't have to do it. The men in green told us to get down. And they had, you know, like that, gotten down. And that's how we left them. They were down. They assured us we didn't have to. And we walked out across the courtyard. That picture stays in my mind, you know. Their immediate compliance. And reassuring us, you know, don't worry, you don't have to do it. What it was for, I have no idea. Whether it was just that the guards wanted to be able to tell us apart from the inmates, or whether there was something else going on, I have no idea. But I came away with this incredible feeling, you know, of how dedicated these men were. And then I found out later that one of them expects to be released in March and expects to come to San Jose to live with his daughter. So immediately I'm thinking, oh, I want to give him information about our group in San Jose. And there's a Zen group also in San Jose. And there's another Zen group in Mountain View. And I was all ready to, you know. And I got home and, you know, over the next day or so began to reflect about it and thought, oh, well, maybe I should check out with some people. You know, if it's okay if I invite someone who has just been released from San Quentin to come and sit. So that's a whole other process, you know, that I will need to check out and see. Hopefully it will be okay. So then I thought about this book, Finding Freedom, and Jarvis Masters, who is at San Quentin, has been there since 1981, is now on death row. And as we walked in, the teacher did point out this row of rooms or lights, windows, and said, that's death row. Jarvis came to practice at San Quentin, I believe through his public defender, and has written this book, Finding Freedom, which Buddhist Peace Fellowship is distributing, selling, actually. So here's another man who has found freedom within the walls of San Quentin and has found the value of this practice. And I want to read you a few things that he says. Because again, it's so inspiring to me. It is so difficult to integrate my meditation practice with all the suffering here. In trying to live a life that reflects the Buddha's ways, I fail continuously. I know so little. I'm just hanging in there with my meditation. Practice is my best companion. It is almost unimaginable to think of what I might be like if I didn't have the Dharma, my teacher, and the love and care of my friends. They have enabled me to turn a situation as bad as mine into an opportunity to be of some benefit, if not for myself, then for school kids and their teachers and counselors who write to say that I'm making a difference, that my writings and my example are an inspiration in their lives. I hope to be able to continue because it allows me to transcend my present circumstances, to transform everything around me into something almost radiant, filled with a chance to make a difference in my own life and in the world. The freedom to be and express myself is what's most important to me. It means waking up every morning content with the Dharma in my life, with my prayers to be of benefit to others, and with my writings giving voice to my human worth. I simply want to live day by day as close to all my aspirations and freedom as I can. Every effort I make to love means I don't have to feel hatred. Meditation has become something I cannot do without. I see and hear more clearly, feel more relaxed and calm, and I actually find my experiences slowing down. I'm more appreciative of each day as I observe how things constantly change and dissolve. I've realized that everything is in a continual process of coming and going. I don't hold happiness or anger for a long time. It just comes and goes. And what Sogyal Rinpoche, who is a Tibetan teacher in Berkeley, says, Jarvis Master's words and stories burn with the flames of a heart-stopping honesty and compassion. They show how spiritual practice and meditation can change a life completely and speak of the triumph of the human heart over even the deepest desperation of death row. And Bo Lozoff, who wrote We're All Doing Time, a very wonderful book and very helpful in prison work. Like a letter from an old friend, no defensiveness, no complaining, no posturing. Master's writing lets us know what the timeless spiritual journey feels like, our journey, from within the walls of one of the nation's most notorious prisons. I wish everyone in America would read this book. The book is filled with vignettes, little stories about life at San Quentin. And some of it is pretty unpleasant to read, pretty horrifying. But some of it, especially his reaction and the way he has changed over time, is pretty inspiring. One vignette that I read just the other day was of an incident where, as you may know, homosexuality is often not tolerated in prisons. For all their security, prisons can be amazing places of harm and destruction. So one day, Jarvis is out in the exercise yard, and this new man walks out. And apparently, you know, at least to Jarvis, flaming homosexual. It was very obvious the moment he saw him. And his thought was, this man is not going to last 5 minutes out here. What do I do? At first, you know, he thought he was helpless. He didn't think he could do anything. And he saw one of the other inmates with a shank. I don't know what a shank is, but a blade or something, I suppose, he said in his right pant leg. And he knew this man was a target. He was a Sitting Bull. And apparently there was a guard tower up above. And he knew one of the inmates would attack this homosexual, and the guards would use it as an excuse to shoot. So he knew somebody or buddies were going to be killed from experience, you know. And he even suggested it could have been a setup, that the guards allowed this man or even encouraged him out to this yard knowing something like this would happen, and then they could shoot and ta-da. So while he's thinking, you know, this is going to happen and I'm powerless, sort of without thinking, he walks over to this man and begins a conversation with him, knowing that his life is now in jeopardy. They could go after him as well as this other man. But as it would happen, they didn't. That gesture on his part calmed the situation. He talked to the man, and I can't remember now what he said, but got the man to exit the exercise yard and go somewhere else, and the incident, you know, didn't happen. But it's those kinds of things that he talks about, his different ways of responding that he attributes to practice. He said, you know, before practice, he wouldn't have done that. And before practice, he took part in, you know, the name-calling, all the stuff that goes on. So there are several vignettes throughout the book of how his response to the situation, to the other inmates, the guards, has totally changed through his practice. And he finds freedom. He's still, as far as I know, he's still on death row. He's still going through appeals. So he still faces execution. And yet, which one of it? Sobiel said or Bo said, no complaining, no posturing. He has found freedom. So that's pretty inspiring to me. And then I think about my own life and how this practice has changed my life. Totally, totally changed my life. I began in 1986, and as I said, for the first probably 4 years, I couldn't have told you why I was doing it, what was happening, why I kept going back. I just did. Something greater than myself brought me to the cushion. And I would say it was probably a pretty, for several years, it was pretty smooth, you know, course. I just felt better and better, and things got better and better, and it was lovely. However, the friend that took me to sit the first time says that she told me, advised me not to get started, not to do it, that this was not an easy path and that I should turn back now. I don't remember her saying that, but she claims she did. But I have heard from so many other people that it's not an easy path. The spiritual life is not an easy life. And after a few years, then I began to find out that it's not. Or it's not necessarily. Maybe for some people it is. But for many of us, it's not. And I knew after a while that I wanted freedom. Nothing less. I wanted freedom. And my sense is that life took me seriously. Life said, okay, you want freedom? Here's what you've got to do. And what I feel I have experienced, what has happened, is that everything I was attached to, well, almost everything, everything that I identified with has fallen away. And my ego has kicked and screamed and fought and just played havoc with that falling away. No, this can't be. It seemed like at times I was drowning in my own self-doubt, in my own insecurity. All my demons have come up. I have faced so much fear. I have said so many times, it's unbelievable a body can hold so much fear. And I'm not a fearful person. I can be quite adventurous and quite a risk taker, but I have faced so much fear. There have been literally years I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what was happening. And yet I have to say, through it all, never for a moment did I doubt the practice or did I think of giving it up. That wasn't an option. Never, never occurred to me. And sometimes, in the not too distant past, I thought, I actually wrote to someone, this practice has destroyed my life. Before I started practicing, you know, I was successful, I was respected, I was a lot of things. And it seemed like all that fell away. And there was part of me, for many years, there was sort of this parallel process going on. Where on the one hand, I was feeling freer and happier than I had ever been in my life. And on the other hand, I thought my life was totally falling apart. I didn't understand. I thought, you know, this is craziness. I feel now like I'm coming out of that. And I don't feel so much that my life is falling apart. In some ways, it has fallen apart. As I say, anything that I could hold as an identity has fallen away. The ego, you know, I never thought I had a big ego. Well, I didn't have a big ego in that sense. But man, I had an ego that was so tightly wound up, I look back, I can hardly believe it. And it did not like for one moment having its power dashed. And that's what has happened, you know? So there's so much less power in that ego. There's so much less ego. And I feel so much more open and spacious and loving and free. I'm not totally free, but I'm so much more than I used to be. And probably there are many things in my life that have contributed to that. But I know that this practice is the foundation. This practice, which led me to the desire for freedom. I didn't come into this practice even knowing about freedom, let alone desiring it. But that desire arose naturally. It just appeared and has never left. It's not so intense right now, I guess. But it's never left. And I now see freedom as a day-to-day thing. It's not something out there to attain. It is, and always has been, right here, as all the great sages and teachers say. It is right here. What I have to do is clear away the muck, all of the stuff that overlays or that hides the freedom, and let the freedom be there. let the freedom shine. And when I do, I'm very happy. And it makes absolutely no difference what's going on in my life. That's not the point. I'm happy because there's freedom. Then what happens, I discover, is not that the things in my life change. You know, it's not that, oh, now my life is wonderful and easy and everything flows so easily and, you know, no complaints. That's not it at all. But as Gil has said so many times, my relationship to it has changed. And when your relationship to it changes, well, that changes it. That changes everything. So now the events happen. You know, they're just events. I deal with them. And they don't have the same meaning that they used to. They don't say who I am. They don't determine whether I'm a good person or a bad person or a lovable person or an unlovable person. They're just events. They're just, sometimes they're struggles, sometimes they're difficulties, sometimes there's great pleasantness. And more I meet them with some equanimity. Not so much of this, you know, not so much of the up and down, but, oh, this is what's next. And through it all, Gil has been there. I may not have been able to chart the waters to stay the course if I had not had Gil as my teacher. Always there, no matter what. Always believing in me. Trusting I came to see not just me, but the process. I knew it wasn't always just me that he trusted, but it was the process. He knew, he's been through the process. He knew the process. He knew it worked. And he knew, I think he sensed that, you know, I wasn't going anywhere. I was on this path and I was going to be there. So, of course, I feel eternal gratitude to him for that. And to the practice. That is always here. Whether I sit every day on the cushion or not, doesn't matter anymore. I do this practice. Whether I'm on the cushion or giving a Dharma talk or swimming in the swimming pool or whatever I'm doing, the practice has me, I would say, and it's always here. A little booklet that one of the inmates gave me is by Thich Nhat Hanh, and it says, it's entitled "Be Free Where You Are." And I think that's so perfect. Wherever we are, San Quentin, IMC, our daily work, our daily lives, wherever, we can be free wherever we are. So we have a few minutes. I'd like to ask any of you if you would be willing to share your experience, what the practice has meant to you, or questions for those of you that might be new to the practice.
When you say the practice, and I don't know if that, is it different things for different people? Does it mean embracing Buddhism? Does it mean meditating or everything or something?
You know what? That's a really good question. What does it mean? All of that? The meditation practice? The mindfulness practice? I think at the very beginning, and still, but particularly at the very beginning, the mindfulness practice was so important. And of course, we practice on the cushion so we can do it in our everyday lives. After doing mindfulness practice, I discovered, you know, I enjoyed the symphony so much more. I heard the music. I heard the different instruments. I saw things in nature that I saw them in a different way than I used to. You know, I saw flowers. I saw colors. I remember one time, I've said this in other talks, going for a walk at Point Reyes with a group of people and just, you know, noticing this and that and the other, and somebody said to me finally, "Wow, you have good eyes." And I knew it didn't have anything to do with my eyes. It was the mindfulness, you know, paying attention. So the mindfulness has been incredibly valuable and important, because then I began to see not just specific things, but, you know, concepts, and then myself, you know, how I believed certain things about life, about myself, without question, just because that was the cultural agreement or my family agreement or whatever. So in a way, mindfulness calls into question every part of you. But I actually do mean something bigger than that. And how to say it. The meditation practice brings us back to ourselves. And on a superficial level, that can mean Brigitte, Robert, Lynn, whatever. But in a larger context, it's who we truly are, Buddha nature. Or other traditions call it that. Or Christ consciousness or Christ nature or the unconditioned or whatever word we use. So remembering that, remembering who I am, remembering my connection. And it's really more than connection. It's that I can't be disconnected from any of you or anybody else or anything else. What animates this life animates all life. And when I experience that freedom, that openness, that's how it is. Then, of course, the ego comes in and, you know, does its thing, and I can contract again. And I have to remember and let go. And then there's that openness again. Does that? Yeah.
But let's say we follow this kind of practice, but I know the answer to this, and I think it's right, but I want to check it out. But we all do it in different ways, right? I mean, there's no prescribed.
That is one of the biggest lessons I've learned. You're right. The path can look different for each of us. Yeah. And that has been part of my suffering, you know, comparing my path to somebody else and saying, oh, but, you know, it didn't work that way for me. I must be doing something wrong. That and believing that if I were truly on the path, then my life would just fall into place and everything would be fine and, you know, there wouldn't be any troubles. Just be smooth. Well, it's not. So, yeah, I think that's crucial, that we each have our own path. And in a way, nobody can tell us what that is. And this is where Gil was so, not was, continues to be so useful to me. Never thinking that he knew how my path should be. He could give me suggestions, he could give me ideas. Of course, he said one time, you know, well, I'm not going to give you any ideas because you never do them. Yeah, but you don't know how valuable that is to struggle against what you tell me. Yes.
I was just interested in, I've heard the expression "into nature" in different contexts, and I was wondering if you related in some ways what you were describing as a kind of openness and interconnectedness, or if it's more specific than that.
Probably less specific. You know, it's the kind of thing that you can't describe, you have to experience. I read somewhere, you can only be it. You can't describe it. You can't talk about it. You can only be it. In my experience, in my understanding, I see Buddha nature as being like Christ consciousness, love, peace, the deathless, you know, the undescribable. Yeah. I have come to see, at least, you know, from my perspective, that the major religions, the Tao, all speak of the same thing, but they use different words, they use different terminology. But as best I can see, as best I understand the readings, and it's the same thing. Does that?
That was less specific.
Right. I've actually found it very useful to read other traditions, like the Tao Te Ching, which I think says it so beautifully. Mm-hmm. The Vedantic tradition. More, of course, my roots were Christian, so more and more, I can see beyond the organized religion, the, you know, dogma that gets thrown about, to the deeper meaning. And that's why I say Christ consciousness, love, I don't know what else to call it. But the mystics, the saints, you know, when you read them, it seems to me they're talking about the same thing. Yeah. And it's not about rules and laws, and although ethics certainly is part of it, but that's not what it's about. Yeah. Anybody else have experience that you can speak to? Yeah?
I guess I came to practice more out of crisis, and some of that had to be, I probably didn't know it at the time, but it was clinically depressed. And that came from a hostile work environment. And the time I felt that my whole ego, this whole career I'd worked really hard on, was just crumbling and falling apart. And began to sit, do mindfulness meditation, and then started to really find the Dharma to be much more helpful. The mindfulness part was wonderful in that you started to enjoy just being in your body, being in the world, the Dharma was much more powerful in meeting the world. Bringing that cushion, bringing your practice off the cushion, and then deciding how much attention you were going to give, how much power were you going to give these other people, how much attention, where you wanted to put your attention, and how you wanted to be in the world. That's been life-changing. Because at any given point in time, good things and bad things will happen to you during the day. It's what you decide to focus on. And how important is it that someone cut you off, or, you know, that you waited, you know, the person in the checkout line had, you know, 20 items instead of 15. You know, what's the point? And so that's dramatically changed. What is important? Mm-hmm. And although this thing did seem like an awful, it was awful, and it was career changing. And I found myself being one of them. Mm-hmm. And then it dawned on me that I just don't belong here. I just don't belong here. And I wish I had decided that for you earlier. I'm grateful for some of the decisions you've done.
You know, I see so clearly in my own life, I do things when I do them. Mm-hmm. And somebody else might look and say, or I might even think I should have done it 3 years ago, but you know what? If I could have, I would have, I guess.
I could have been there 3 years longer.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, it takes you that long to, like, get it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. It happens when it happens. And when you mentioned the checkout line, that made me think that's when I remember my breath. And it's so nice, you know. I feel that irritation. Breathe. Were you good?
Yeah, this is not a question. I'm just realizing, I don't know why I'm here tonight. I just came because I knew you'd be. But it is the first of the year, and so I like to use this as a springboard to try and do things more regularly, change. So I guess I'm talking right now because if I say it publicly, maybe it would help me, but you know, every year I know I say I'm going to read more, and I'm going to meditate more, and then I do my life, which includes those once in a while. But I know how important for me meditating is, because my mind can get very busy. So this has inspired me to gives me a little bit extra. Go for it.
Good. I was surprised to see you walk in. But I know you. And I know. I know this man. And there is a deep desire, longing. And don't worry about how it looks. Don't worry about how it looks. And you know what I would say? Don't even say to yourself, I'm going to meditate more, I'm going to read more.
Just
do your life. Yeah. Yeah. Trust, Robert. It's there.
I'm going to do a quiet affirmation.
Okay. Yeah. Anybody else? In Dharamsala?
Really close to it. And fell apart. I was just too unusual. It was just too different. And I couldn't kind of escape when you talk about fear. I just couldn't escape my own fear. But as I was going back to Delhi, I'd never done this before, but I just started repeating the, may I be safe, may I be healthy, and I substitute sense of wonder at ease in the world, but it's like suddenly there's sort of this, I just sort of calmed down. And I ended up being able to settle down for a more extended amount of time as opposed to having to get on a plane and come home.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that I came back and I said, well, this must have some connection to me. I wouldn't have to pursue it. And so I just kind of continued and recovered. I think what you said was really helpful to me. I don't know why I'm here, but I do know why.
Yeah.
And it's sort of very ironic, Tibetan Buddhist nunnery, people all around me that are experienced and experts. And I couldn't say. It's sort of like I had to come back to the United States in order to experience Buddhism.
But it's here for you to experience. So. Wonderful. Thanks for sharing. Shall we sit for the last 5 minutes? Happy New Year to you all. Have a safe drive home.